to Lesson 21. We're going to continue today with Part 2, NGO Diplomacy and Influence. First of all, what we're going to do is look at the various stages of international negotiations. Now, the point of going through these stages is that it will give you a way to look more specifically at what is otherwise a rather nebulous concept of quote-unquote international negotiations, or on the other hand, global impact. And this will begin the process of giving you a way to look at this. And secondly, we'll begin to look at what we mean by influence and the kind of evidence that there is of the influence that we're talking about. Next, we're going to make some quick assessments of effect of the various elements that have been looked at. This lesson does not go exhaustively into any of the studies of all of this work, but again, hopes to give you an overview and pull out the key points that can be useful to you as an activist at the United Nations or in international work of some kind. And then I want to go into a framework for strategic NGO impact, and this is my own perspective and frame that I offer at this time. And then I want to close with a few more observations that have been made on the work of NGOs at the international level. So the stages of influence. Of course, there's the most obvious, and here we're going to kind of work from the most obvious, kind of the tip of the iceberg type of place, and work backwards. When we think of impacting global affairs, we have to, or we naturally tend to think in terms of global level policies, resolutions that are made, international agreements that are made, and that is the more obvious impact. But by the time you get to the stage of being engaged in international conferences that produce these outcomes, so much of the work is already done and opportunities for influence have already passed. Now, from the point of view of NGOs, there is going to be very little opportunity for an NGO to overtly be involved in an intergovernmental negotiation process. By that time, the best that an NGO will be able to do will be to indirectly influence the negotiation process. If they're in the room, they may be part of the team as an expert, as an advisor, as somebody invited there and to help improve the debate or the, you know, give the information that is needed for negotiations at that time, but they will not be directly involved. So by the time you get to those negotiations, there have already been influenced during the pre-negotiation and the agenda setting phases. So by the time people are sitting down at the negotiations, many of the things that can continue to influence the outcomes at this stage, such as procedures, agendas, and substantive elements, have already been established in earlier meetings and pre-negotiations. And so part of the question is, how did these negotiations come about in the first place? How do those, in other words, realistically, if we want to influence the outcomes of the negotiations, we can see that it's very natural to start and look back earlier and earlier and earlier to the pre-negotiation phase, and even prior to the pre-negotiation phase to the agenda setting phases. And this is important because sometimes NGOs feel like, okay, I'm going to go to the United Nations and I'm going to get involved, without realizing that by the time you walk into the United Nations, at best, an NGO is going to be able to observe the negotiations between nations. And that if, in fact, you want to have any kind of significant impact, you need to go back to the earlier and earlier and earlier phases. And since you can't go back in time, you need to consider getting involved in the early stages of the whole process. So let's take a couple of moments to look a little bit more closely at some of these elements. There is the issue framing stage. This is when the pressing challenge is described and assessed, as having particular short-term and long-term impacts and relevance to different issues and so on. So taking, for example, the human trafficking issue, as it was reframed not just as a criminal issue or a justice issue, but in fact as a modern form of human slavery, discussions took on a different tone and have since had a quite distinctly different impact. Framing then addresses the issue of context, and that the context maybe has a timing component to it, as well as cultural, social, and political environment. And so is in fact a very key place that influence can be made. Because even if the issue is very critical, if it's not articulated and communicated well, it can easily get dropped as unimportant or secondary or something that we just can't deal with right at this moment. So part of the work that needs to be done in the framing work is to bring it up in the priority level to help it be framed in ways that touches the hot buttons of the, and especially of the key stakeholders of the day. Now, prior to the framing is agenda setting. And so that's especially possible if an NGO has a very innovative initiative. If in fact that agenda is not even on the global agenda at this time, it creates an opportunity to set the agenda, to put it on the global agenda. That's the more dramatic version. As I referred to or referenced just a few seconds ago in issue framing, it is important to understand the position of the key actors, because all of these are very much interwoven components. And so understanding the position of key actors on this particular agenda that you might be addressing, that is your particular strength, your NGO's strength. As noted in earlier sessions, you do have to do your homework and find out who those key actors are. Then you do need to work to understand what their positions are. And if they are key actors and their position is currently not favorable to your agenda, that means that you have a strategic point of focus to go in and to either influence that understanding or to find other key actors who maybe can help do you the influencing for you. Again, these are all strategic choices that you and or your NGO will need to make. Then, as we've mentioned in the last lesson, there are ways to indirectly at the influence the global level agendas and work by focusing on the national or domestic levels and creating your impact there first, and then that impact can be taken to the global level. So these are key stages of influence for you to factor into your thinking as you seek to make quote-unquote global impact. Now we're going to just take a couple of minutes to look at the measures and challenges of success. In other words, can the outcomes be tracked back to positions that NGOs took? And does the text reflect these positions? Now, in fact, a lot of the difficulty of being able to speak definitively about the role of NGOs in international negotiations is that so often there are very few ways to prove that NGOs impacted the outcomes using simple measures of success. In other words, case studies and the stories of NGOs are a very important part of measuring and assessing success. So there's not always a paper trail. You can't always track exactly a document that an NGO submitted to a government and then to find it in the final documentation, though that can happen. And that is one of the ways that you can measure your success. If in fact you've got phrases or terminology that is uniquely coming from an NGO, that you can, if it's found in the final outcome documents of the United Nations, that is clearly a measure of success. But that will happen very rarely. as we went over in the documents section in an earlier module, realized that documents get done over royally by the governments themselves. They get picked to pieces, they get words changed, preferred words and phrases to satisfy one government or another. In short, it's really hard to trace an idea and to prove its ownership or even just its birth, from the first time it is proposed to who picks it up, to who carries it forward, to who articulates it well or the best, to who negotiates over it, and to who ends up, quote-unquote, owning it by the time it comes out as a UN document or at the outcome of an international conference. And this is not always all that easy for governments to do either. Now, I'm not going to go into the ins and outs of tracking particular countries' involvements in specific processes here. The important thing here is to consider is if you're going to be spending time and energy making an effort to influence international discussions and outcomes, NGOs do need to know that we can have some kind of impact and where we are most likely to be able to have the greatest impact. We all have limited resources, member states as well as NGOs. So it does make sense that we do analyze what we're doing, that we investigate the whole process and try to best understand the places where our involvement leverages the greatest amount of change. So continuing on, influence is also established through informal meetings and discussions, just the same as for traditional diplomatic negotiations. Now, one of the challenges that has occurred since 9/11, and I just throw this out because other people acknowledge it as well, although it doesn't have to be the end of the world, and any challenge is usually some kind of, also creates some kind of opportunity, but that since 9/11, there has been increased suspicion of NGOs. Oftentimes, NGOs are looked at by governments as a potential wolf in sheep's clothing, potentially cloaking the work of terrorist groups or those with some kind of an alternative agenda. Of course, this is nothing new. It's just that the heightened security and discussions of terrorist activity at all levels of the world has given those who were suspicious of NGOs in the first place a way to speak more boldly about that. Again, going into what we mean by influence and how do we identify it? What kind of evidence is there? As mentioned, scholars frequently have to rely on evidence regarding NGO activities by the information that's been submitted or handed off to member states or those others involved in the negotiation process. Suggested draft documents, draft decisions to negotiators, you know, or position papers that may have been submitted to countries. But again, picking those up and seeing the connection, the specific connection with the outcome document is difficult. But it remains that lobbying and draft documents, concept papers, white papers is one of the ways that you influence the outcomes. In some cases, NGOs can be part of a negotiating team. So that is another place, and how to go about that is as greatly varied as there are countries and circumstances, issues, and agendas. And that is another means of influence. And whether or not NGOs can participate in that manner depends on the rules of participation, whether or not NGOs can participate directly or whether they would have to become adopted as part of a particular country's negotiating team. NGO resources also affect the amount of influence, such as their knowledge of the area, their financial capacities and their own financial resources, as well as other assets such as the networks of people that they have access to, either in particular countries, regions, or worldwide, and the particular role that they have in the negotiations. Now let's look at some little or large effect of some of these. NGOs shape the process by working behind the scenes, raising concerns about issues and influencing the positions of states. Given how difficult it is to really measure that kind of influence, In the end, the assessment will need to be made by the NGO themselves, whether or not they feel that the difference that they were able to make by influencing the position of states was adequate given the amount of investment and the shifts and changes that they observed taking place. They may never be able to make a perfectly accurate assessment about their own ability to influence the states. However, in the end, that's where the assessment will lie. Whether or not an NGO has an alliance with key states that are crucial to the overall issue will alter the extent of influence. If an NGO is really spearheading something but they have no relationship with key states, does make a difference. Or if, in fact, they are what could be considered a political liability to the key actors, that is going to be a factor whether or not it's in fact helpful to have that NGO very active with the key states. So I think just by simply making that point, you can see that different decisions and different strategies need to be adopted according to even those kinds of issues. Why did I bring that one up? Because I know that the particular NGO that I worked with was effectively a political liability for a number of the member states central to the issue. Therefore, that hugely affected my strategies. NGOs can keep things on the agenda or get things off the agenda, just as member states can. And that is, in fact, a tactic that some people use, even at the conferences. Some people, just as there is filibustering in the Congress in Washington, D.C., there can be the equivalence at the United Nations by getting agendas, getting items virtually off the agenda by one means or another. Again, that comes back to utilizing procedures and maneuvering tactics. But NGOs also can work to get things on the agenda. They can also work to get things off the agenda through their chosen strategy. My own experience is that NGOs can influence things more at the agenda setting level. And again, that may be by putting things on or getting things off the agenda. In the study by Michelle Betzel and Elizabeth Carell, and written up in the book NGO Diplomacy, Betzel concluded that the environmental community had a moderate level of influence on the negotiations and little on the outcomes. In other words, that in the end, there was not a lot of influence that was actually had by NGOs by the time you get things into the negotiation phase. Those agendas, this is just a point to note, that those issues or agendas or agenda items that did validate a bottom-up approach actually strengthened the NGO ability to influence. Where governments recognize that certain issues are best addressed strategically from the bottom up rather than from the top down, this then enhances the NGO ability to influence, because that's where NGOs have their greatest effect on the ground, the grassroots level, and their greatest influence and effect is in the bottom-up approach. NGOs that have homogeneity, of course, strengthen their ability to influence. If NGOs speak as one voice, and especially if they actually cover a broad spectrum, either regionally or statistically, if there is a more singular voice, they can have greater influence, and especially when the issue is new. When participation of NGOs is encouraged by negotiators, obviously then NGOs can have much more of an impact. In other words, if NGOs are invited in, as opposed to an issue that NGOs are saying, look, we have something to say, you need to listen to us. Of course, it's just like, so again, part of the point of saying some of these things, that it can give you ideas as to how you can go about doing your larger work at the United Nations. You can perhaps seek to find ways to get negotiators to invite you in if your area is relevant and can in fact be helped by your expertise. And a typical example of such a situation would be when an NGO has scientific or specific expert knowledge. Additionally, a key point here is that the science or the experts are not splintered. Then the impact, of course, will be greater. But even so, it's still usually indirect. The negotiators themselves carry the weight of influence, and NGOs' influence in that sense will remain indirect when there is heightened public concern. In other words, those NGOs who can either increase the media attention on a particular topic, or if NGOs are working on a topic that happens to be in an area where there is heightened media attention, will have much more of an ability to influence what is going on. And of course, what resources, financial resources they have, and people resources. NGO influence was greater when the agenda was shaped early on. We've mentioned that before. And this next point, we have to remember that influence does happen by NGOs largely over time, even though it is less pinpointable. You can't always measure it so easily. It's harder to track, but it is fairly well accepted that a lot of the NGO influence is in through persistence and ongoing influence over time. Also, where NGOs are successful at reframing even old ideas, influence can be greater. Old issues, such as the shift from forest conservation from an issue of economics to one of environmental and human rights, that is one of the ways to increase the impact. And again, we'll go into framing very soon in this week in our sessions on advocacy. And this last point here is just to underscore that it's really more meaningful to discuss influence in a case-by-case way because of the centrality of individual capacities, goals, agendas, strategies, and all of that that are tied up with each individual NGO rather than making some kind of a generalization. Now I'm at the place in the lesson where I want to introduce you to a framework within which you can make plans for your NGO's actions at the United Nations or at some other international meeting or even in your local community. However, I've also got one eye on the time, and already, as usual, I really don't have time to go into this thoroughly here. So I'll introduce you to the bare bones outline of this, and then in another lesson, we'll go into this in detail. The tips for this massive action plan are these. First of all, transformative thinking. I'm going to have to go into that, how we think about change, the assumptions that we need to affect more dramatic change, and the characteristics of the kind of thinking that is focused, clear, and persuasive. The second one is to innovate, and I'll explain about the kind of innovation that is helpful in this kind of a context. And in fact, we deal with some of these innovations in the context of looking at framing. But there are certain characteristics that can make them more powerful than other versions of framing the issue. I want to make it clear that to influence at the international level, you also need to provide promising proof that this is an essential element. Having the grandest idea and the most powerful conviction is not sufficient. It's necessary, but not sufficient. And so therefore, you need to build into your plans that of providing promising proof. And there are certain ways that you need to go about presenting this proof for greatest effect. And finally, to keep the backdrop of understanding of a success as incremental and generative. It's very important that we do not underestimate the potency of small shifts to initiate significant change. These massive action plan tips are very potent, very exciting, and I look forward to going over them with you in a special lesson at some later date. So let's skip right to the homework from here. First of all, I want you to think about, and this is connected to the last lesson, but what kind of an NGO do you consider yours is? Think about it. Is it essentially focused on environmental issues? Or similarly, it's concerned with some element of the global commons? Are you a social movement? And so, in that sense, your values and your concerns are absolutely transnational. They are connected to those with common values wherever they may be within the world. Are you community-based? Does your NGO primarily function at the community level? And is that where you get your energy, your resources, your qualifications, your authority? And how well do you use that? Are you a mix of all of these? Do think about the kind of NGO yours essentially is. And so therefore, what strategies for influence are appropriate to your NGO? So, can you have more impact through local, national levels? Or would you be more effective making regional and even global level alliances? The important thing here is to think about the nature of your NGO, the ways in which you work, and therefore beginning to get some sense of what kinds of strategies for influence and impact that is best for your NGO. Next, just one more question. Is your agenda, your main agenda, already on the UN's agenda? Do you know? Is it there? And if it is not, perhaps you could begin to think about how you might go about getting it there. Are you going to work by, first of all, making a statement to ECOSOC and trying to get it on the agenda that way? Are you going to target a few member states that have similar values on that particular agenda? Is it best for you to work through primarily through being effective at the national level or a few nations level in order to then get that nation, your nation, to spearhead that issue at the United Nations? Anyway, the point is here not necessarily to come up with all of the answers and solutions for your NGO, because that's not the way those solutions will be figured out in actual fact, but to get you to think a little bit more specifically, carefully, and accurately about your own NGO and the ways in which it may be able to be more influential and effective in the world. With that, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.